What's going on, everybody? It's be your boy
DJ Anonymous.
DJ Anonymous with another episode of Sports Biz Music, the podcast, and this is 156. And I got a very, very special guest on the show. I have Jason Torchinski on the show today. Yep. I said it right.
Yeah, Torchinski, that's right. How you doing?
I'm doing good. I'm doing well. Before we get into the podcast and the questions and whatnot, you know, introduce yourself to the listeners.
Sure. So I currently run an automotive website called The Autopian. And I'm an automotive journalist, and that just means I just write about cars and pretty much anything having to do with cars and car culture. In any kind of way, I write about that kind of stuff. And I have a book that I wrote about autonomous cars that came out a little bit ago called Robot Take the Wheel. Mm-hmm. So basically what I do is I just I write about cars. I do graphics and design and drawings of cars, all these things. Just, you know, we have our website. We put up multiple stories every day. And I travel a lot to drive interesting cars. It's a fantastic gig. I love that I get to do it.
So what made you want to get into cars, like growing up? Like that was like what was like the first car or whatnot?
So, I mean, it's strange, you know, like there's people who grew up in families where like their parents or their dad is really into cars. My dad was not at all. My dad could barely staple. He was not he was not super into cars, but I always him. And he actually had a car when I was a kid growing up that really sparked my interest. It was an old Beetle, an old VW Beetle. And those kind of became my favorite car as a little kid. And through Beetles, because I grew up in the 70s and 80s, because I'm an old man. And at the time, you know, I grew up in North Carolina. And at the time, you know, the cars that you would see around you in that part of the country at that time were mostly like, primarily like big American cars and, you know, a bunch of Japanese cars, like Accords. But the Beetles always stood out because they did everything differently than all the other cars. The engine was at the back instead of the front. They were shaped differently. They sounded different. They were cooled by air instead of water. And they just really got my attention. And so it was through them that I kind of got interested in other cars, mostly strange cars. And I would go to the library because this is before the internet was, you know, really available. Mm-hmm. And I would get like, I would read through all the books they had about cars. And when I finished those, I would get travel books of places in like Europe and Asia. And I'd get like a big book of like, you know, Czechoslovakia, Prague. And I would find all the weird cars I couldn't identify there. And then I would just do all I could to try to figure out what the hell they were. And over the years, I just kind of ended up just being really interested in cars just as like a hobby. It was never my career path growing up. I did more art stuff. I always drew, and I wanted to be a cartoonist. Mm-hmm. When I went to college, I actually studied art history, which is basically, I can identify, if you put some Egyptian art in front of me, I could probably tell you what dynasty it came from. And that's just not a skill that actually comes up all that often in real life. It would never stop me and ask me to identify what dynasty an Egyptian thing was from. But so I had an art history background, but I always worked on publications, like newspapers and magazine kind of things in like high school and college. And I was also always interested in comedy. So I did a lot of stand-up like through college. And after that, I moved to L.A. to start a comedy group. I opened for George Carlin once a long time ago. So I did a lot of that. And then that kind of led me into other kinds of writing. Like, you know, The Onion, you know, the Onion satirical website.
I believe I heard about it before.
Yeah, it's pretty big. And so I wrote for them as like just an idea writer for their video side for a while. Mm-hmm. And I started a company too. So, and I also was doing a lot of graphic design. Computer-based graphic design and interface design. And I was making, like, video games in, like, the late 90s, late 2000s, and that CD-ROM boom era, just as the internet was starting out. And we'd had one of the first online game sites in, like, 98, 99 called The Blip. And then some friends and I, while we were out in L.A., we started a webcasting company that did like online, like video and slides and chat and poll. But you know, there was no pandemic back then, which would have been, you know, like because it did a lot of the same things Zoom did, just in like 2002. But the internet wasn't necessarily really ready for it then, and we got some venture capital to try to start the company, and they put in their own CEO, and that kind of turned out to be a disaster, and the whole thing just became a real, just an albatross. It was just became a nightmare, and I lost a lot of money in my like late 20s and early 30s. Wow. And it was a disaster. The product was good. It's just everything around it wasn't really ready. And we had, like, we'd even talked to Microsoft at one point about it possibly being acquired, but they didn't do it. Like, we had a lot of near misses where things felt like, okay, this is going to be it. There was like just enough to keep us going. Oh, like continuing, but it would just turn out to be just difficult. And, but so eventually, so then, you know, around 2010, like I kept it going for a while. In 2010, we got my wife, we decided to have a kid. So my wife's pregnant and I didn't have health insurance and I was trying to keep this little company going along. And I realized this is not sustainable.
Yeah, like entrepreneurship life.
Exactly. It was just, but at some point you have to have the clarity to like know when to just say enough. Mm-hmm. And the pregnancy is what really made me realize I can't keep doing this. So I got a job teaching at a high school in LA, in the LA USD. Mm-hmm. And I was teaching design, graphic design. And, you know, teaching is, like, I loved teaching to the kids who gave a damn. Like, if the kids gave a shit, I loved teaching them. They were fantastic. But I hated trying to force kids to pay attention if they didn't care and do things like policing if they were wearing hats or crap like that. I just didn't want to do that. You know, it just wasn't pleasant, and I kind of hated the job.
Yes.
But so while I was doing that, I was still writing on the side. And I wrote for a magazine called Make Magazine, which does a lot of DIY stuff. And for them, because I was always still interested in cars on the side, I propose that there's a race they do all over the country now. And it's for cars that are $500 or cheaper. It's called the 24 Hours of Lemon. And it's for like pieces of crap that you haul out of the junkyard, but you put them back together to make a race car. And then you race them. And it's a hell of a lot of fun because it's like real wheel-to-wheel racing and you're really out there. And so I put together a team and I got Make Magazine to sponsor me. And through that, I started to meet a lot of people who actually were automotive journalists for a living, people who wrote about cars for a living.
Right.
And even right before that, I always had interest in cars. So I always had an old Beetle that I had this old Beetle I had since I was 18. And I still have it. And then I also had this weird British car called a Reliant Scimitar. And someone from the automotive website Jalopnik came out to drive my weird British car because there was, you know, there's like maybe five of them in America. So it was a weird car. So they drove that. And so I kind of started to encounter this like world of people who wrote about cars for a living. And it was very exciting.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I realized this was a possible career option. So while I was kind of dissatisfied as a teacher, I got a side gig writing for Auto Week. And I wrote, you know, I kept with them just for like, it was only like a month or so that I was writing for them when the editor of Jalopnik apparently had seen some of the stuff I'd done and came to me, and it was over winter break in like 2011 and asked me if I want, and because I was a teacher, I was basically off for winter break and, you know, you're off for the summers and winter break and you don't get paid during those times. And normally, like, because I do some.
Yeah, I know because my wife, she's a teacher. Yeah. I don't know.
So, yeah, you know, I mean, they don't get paid great to start with. And then the fact that you have to go 2 months in the summer with zero paycheck, I mean, we treat teachers horribly. I mean, if we're really honest, for as important work as they do. So, you know, I was like, in the summer, I was getting like art commissions, and I did like these big, giant Space Invader sculptures in Culver City, and I had some other things to cover it. But then I realized I didn't have anything. So, this Jalopnik offered me a chance to do it over winter break. So I did it, and some of the things I wrote actually kind of took off. And so they offered me a full-time gig in like 2012 at the very beginning and took it. And then I stayed with Jalopnik for up until February for like 10 solid years of just writing about cars every single day. And it's great.
Wow. So
it was a weird path to get there, I guess.
No, because that's, you know, that's kind of similar to my story because, you know, going back to you in a few minutes, but when I first started, you know, I wanted to, my side gig was music and DJing, and then I wanted to go to school for, you know, to go for, I wanted to be a sports agent one day. Pretty much during that journey, people's always tell me, you know, you a quiet person, but you know how to talk to people. You know how to have conversations with people. And, you know, at the time, I'm like, I don't know what you're talking about. I mean, if I know you, we could converse, we could have conversations and stuff. Like we could, you know, it's easier for me because I know you. But as a DJ, of course, you know, as customer service, you have to always, when you meet people, you know, I was taught, you know, meet people, you know, you give them the perfect customer service, you make sure everything's good, what type of music they want to be played. So,
I just met you and you're very easy to talk to.
Yeah,
so
it's just, I don't know if it's a gift, I don't know, but, and just about 4 years ago, I started the podcasting. And like right now we here, and it's just like hearing your story. It's like you went through you older than me, so you went through a lot. You tried different things, and now you finally found something. It's like it went full circle for you because at the end of the day, you know, you love cars, so right. Now you pretty much there.
Yeah. That's a great point because, like, the idea, like, one thing I realized, like, I always felt like I had a day job, and then I'd spent a lot of times on side projects for all kinds of things, whether I was, like, writing for zines or doing the comedy stuff or building art things. You know, I was always doing these two things to feel satisfied. Like, the day job was never quite enough. I had to do something else. And I was realizing it just takes so much time to do that. If I could just combine something I loved with the thing that made me money. That was always the dream. And I feel like I finally managed to get that with automotive journalism because it combines so many things that I really like cars as a subject, but then writing, I love to write. Mm-hmm. I get to do comedy-ish stuff. I get to be funny in articles if I want to try that. And I get to do plenty of graphics and design because all the articles need good visuals. So I do that. I do video series. So I still get some of the performance aspect. I do, like this series called Jason Drives, it's Torch Drives, and they're the Autopia now, where I just go and find interesting cars, and I drive them, and I talk about them, and I love that. And sometimes, you know, like, being on camera is fun. I genuinely like it, and thanks to things like YouTube, that's a big part of the job now. In fact, I bought a, so during the pandemic, so normally when I would do like a series of these shows every year, but then during the pandemic, nobody wanted to travel. Right. So I had to figure, like, what am I going to do for video if I can't go anywhere? So I thought, well, I'll just get something interesting and do a bunch of videos on that. And my idea was I was going to try to find the cheapest new car in the world that you could buy. And I found, you know, the website Alibaba, you know, that it's like you can buy stuff from China. And
it's like, I guess, like the Amazon, but for, like, I guess, like Asia or whatnot.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. And but they also have a lot of direct links to manufacturers. So I realized they were selling these weird little electric cars there, and I found one that new was $930.
Wow!
And you add batteries to it, and it came to like $1,200, which is still absurdly cheap for a car. And then by the time shipping was all done, it was like $3,000. But whatever, it's still dirt cheap.
Yeah,
basically the cheapest new car you'd get. So I ordered one. And I had it shipped over to America, and I picked it up, and it came in a giant cardboard box. And it's this ridiculous little thing with like a 1.1 horsepower motor, a little electric car. But it'll do about 25 miles an hour. It'll get about 20 miles range. It has a backup camera. It's got it's like an all-metal body. It's like so much better than it has any right to be. And I was so excited by this ridiculous thing called a Changli. I started making videos. And they became huge. Like, there's, like, in each of these videos I've done has, like, 2.5 to 3 million views on for, like, three of these videos. And then they got repeated in China because in China they're known as the name translates to like old man happy car. It's just like, what? Like old men will use it to like drive to the market or to pick up like kids from school or whatever.
Right.
But they're only in like rural areas, and they're kind of, you know, like the idea that like a Westerner, like an American, would be interested in this car for the people who actually lived in China just seemed hilarious. It just seemed like absurd. Like I don't know what the equivalent would be. It'd be like if somebody in Europe bought a Rascal, you know, like those little Rascals that get around. It'd be like bought that, was like, this is the best thing in the world. So that's how they saw me going like nuts over this car. And so in China, these videos picked up. And then, like, I have a friend who, like, works for a Chinese car company. And he messaged me that, like, his father-in-law sent him this video of this goofball American going all crazy over one of these old man happy car things. And it was me. And so it's just insane. The reach that you have now on the internet is just, it's crazy. Like, the fact I could order this ridiculous thing because I couldn't travel. And then it turns into this thing where people literally all over the world are watching me be a fool in front of this car is just, I don't know. It's just a staggering thing, but it's wonderful at the same time. I love that it happened. It's just fun.
Yeah, it's fun. Like it's crazy. I'm glad you brought up the pandemic. Cause I noticed that, the pandemic, I was reading some articles and they were saying the pandemic actually, I guess they forced us to move 10 or 15 years in the future, because you see things right now, you know.
Yeah.
For example, what happened crazy, like Zoom, we were talking about Zoom earlier, and how,
right,
like y'all had something that was similar to Zoom, but it was in 2002. And for me, I was in grad school, you know, I was in grade school, I was in fifth grade. So at that time, only thing I knew about computers was like Microsoft Word and everything. I didn't even think of, like, I didn't even have a webcam growing up until like I got a MacBook. But but yeah, like it was a lot of
you're
creative
right
things coming up, you know, in the pandemic. And I remember actually it was a couple of people in my neighborhood, they had the electric cars.
Yeah.
And like I'm like, what is this? Like, I'm thinking it's like, you know, the regular toy cars. They were like, no. They were like, they could go 25, 30 miles per hour, and, like, you really have to fix it up. So it's like a mini car. I'm like, wow. Like, this is the future. Like.
I mean, this is, like, restrict. Like, whenever you have things that restrict you, it kind of forces you to be more creative. Like, if you give a kid like a big box of 64 crayons and tell them to draw something, it's a lot harder for them to figure out what to draw than if you gave them like three crayons, because the things like the restrictions will inform what you can do.
Mm-hmm.
So the pandemic was this huge amount of restrictions. So we had to figure out how to be creative within the new boundaries of less travel and whatever. And so you get, you know, like technology for communicating over a distance improved dramatically because we had to, we had no choice. Yeah, that's you're absolutely right. Exactly.
So as a journalist, I know you in particular in automotive, but you know, as a journalist, like what's the, I guess, pros and cons? I know you love it, but like, what's the like pros and cons as a journalist, especially like day by day?
Yeah, so the day by day is the key part here, because basically, we have a whole website, and every day you get there and you're confronted with a blank screen and a blinking cursor, and we've got to fill that site with interesting things for people to read. Fundamentally, that's what we do. We you know, and so every day you have to start fresh. You've got to find, you know, it can be stuff like some of the stuff we do has to do with what's happening currently.
Mm.
Some of it is interesting research that we're doing on our own that you think is interesting. Some of it are longer term things, but every single day you've got to figure out what you want to write about, and you've got to figure out how to make what you're interested in something that people you've never met anywhere will also find interesting.
Right.
And you know, that's a lot to deal with. Like during the 10 years I was at Jalopnik, I wrote 6,700 stories.
Wow. That's amazing.
Three a day. Yeah. It's crazy because the pace for online content is crazy. Like you really, you have to, like, we try to, Like right now, since we just started the Utopian, and me, David Tracy was another guy from Jalopnik who I started with, and then Bo Bachman is he's our other partner. He used to be on Pimp My Ride, and he's actually CEO of the Galpin car dealership, the largest Ford dealership in America. So that's where our financial resources.
That's in California, right?
In California, yes. Right? Exactly. He's based in Van Nuys. But the nice thing about Bo is he's got a lot of resources, but fundamentally he's doing this because he also is just someone who loves cars and wants to have an outlet where people can talk about cars in an interesting, fun, informative way. So he's doing it for the right reason. And, you know, when we were trying to find funding for this company, we originally were looking at like venture firms or, like different companies that like, are with loan money or I don't know, but nobody in those places really gave a damn about what we were doing. Right. Bo was different. He actually enjoys and is interested in the fundamental mission, which is just make interesting things for our readers to enjoy and to kind of create a community of people online who love cars and want to talk about them with one another. So every day, you know, we come in and we've got we want to fill in at least a story an hour. It's just me and David, and we have one guy who's like one full-time employee right now. We need to expand. So like we've been up for a month live. We launched this site on March 32nd because we said we promised we were going to do it in March. Then we realized we weren't going to quite make it, so we said, screw it, March 32nd. So that was our launch date.
So and, just recently.
Yeah.
Oh, wow, congratulations, by the way.
Thank you. And actually just last Friday, we hit 1 million page views in that first month. So the growth is happening. Like, we have, our traffic is consistent. Like, there are people who are wanting to come and read the stuff, and that's great, because that's exactly what we want. You want to write things that people want to read. I mean, it's not rocket science. And the thing is, because there's so much that has to be posted every day, the thing that David and I have learned is if you're enthusiastic about something, and it almost doesn't matter what it is, you can make readers enthusiastic about it. And it's just how you approach it. Like, for example, okay, I can't give a good reason for why this is, but one of the things I've always loved about cars, and it's like a weird fetishy thing, are taillights. Like,
oh, the taillights.
I've written about taillights in so much more detail than anybody should ever rationally admit to doing. And if I had to pitch those stories to an editor, I said, hey, I want to write about these weird taillights that were only on VW Beetles in Italy for 1 year. There is no way any editor would say, absolutely, the public has a right to know. They would never say that. But I've written about that stuff, and I've written in such a way that people get interested. Like, you would be shocked at what people are capable of being interested in. And now I'm kind of known as like this weird taillight guy. Like, if something interesting happens in the taillight world, they expect me to have a comment on it. And I usually do. So, I mean, I write about all kinds of things, but you can focus on almost anything. And if your enthusiasm is genuine, if you mean it, if you're not faking it, people will feel that. And they will get interested too. And it almost doesn't matter what it is. You can make any bit of minutia interesting, because there's stories behind everything, and you just got to dig a little and you can find them and make them engaging. So that's every day. We just look for what's interesting in what that has to do with cars in some way. And they're one of the strangest things that humans make and buy. Like, they're completely irrational. If you think about it, like, I imagine you've had a car that you felt emotionally drawn to, I'm sure, at some point, right?
Yeah, it was the Camaro.
Yeah, wonderful car.
Yeah.
Did you still have it, or did you have to get rid of it?
No. My first vehicle was the Impala. It was a 2009 Impala.
Sure.
No, actually, no. It was old. I think it was 2006. I'm trying to remember. I forgot. But I got it. That was like my first car. I graduated from high school, and I love my baby. Like, I had hooked it up, put some rims on it, tents. Yep. You know, I'm a Florida boy, so.
Yeah.
That's what
we make yours.
Yeah.
And then did you have to get rid of it at some point? Like probably for that one, right?
Yeah, because the what was it? It was the I got a brain fart right now. The transmission was bad. Like
yeah,
I mean, like just I had.
Do you remember how you felt when you had to get rid of the car?
I felt sad because it was like, even though I had got a truck, you know, I had traded in, I felt sad because I had so many memories. Like, I remember that car kept me through, like, pretty much my whole college career, you know, so.
Exactly. They're not like other things we own. Like, people have refrigerators for, like, 20 years, and they get rid of them. Nobody cries. Nobody cares when your old washing machine goes away.
Right.
But a car is not the same thing. Like, our relationship with cars is not rational. It's deeply emotional. And even people who say they don't care about cars, I guarantee you can find a car that they wouldn't want to be seen in, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, if someone says, you know, like, they, if someone, like, drives a Prius and they say they get it because it's got good fuel economy and they just don't care about cars, I guarantee you if you put them behind the wheel of, like, a Hummer and made them go pick up their friends, they'd feel weird because it's not them.
Mm-hmm.
It's closer to fashion in some ways than it is. You know, like anything else we buy, you wear a car because it says something about who you are.
Mm-hmm.
And there's for like as you know, after a house, a car is like the biggest, most expensive purchase you'd make, and we buy them for reasons that are objectively kind of crazy, like weird little details about the way they look or sound. Mm-hmm. You know,
yep.
And the fact that we love cars that are like crazy high horsepower cars that you will most people will never ever use the potential of the cars they buy. Like I've you know, part of the job means I get to drive on tracks. Mm-hmm. I get to drive all kinds of circumstances. So I've had fast cars on a track a lot, and it's a hell of a lot of fun.
Oh yeah, you're lucky.
Oh yeah, it's amazing. But like, even when I've had a really powerful car on the track, I've barely used, you know, like a fraction of what these cars are capable of.
Mm-hmm.
And on the road, most people who have like a 700 horsepower, you know, Challenger or something like that, or even like a lot of these new Teslas and EVs that have absurd amounts of power,
yeah.
You're no context where you're going to ever use any of that. But it doesn't matter. We still love it just to know it's there. None of it makes any sense. And again, that's key to why cars will always be interesting.
Always. It kind of reminds me of sneakers in a way.
Good analogy, actually. They're very parallel. You're right.
Yeah, because growing up, my dad used to always say that when I was about 10, 11 months years old, and like I started being, you know, a toddler, he used to tell me that when I was that young, I look at a car and I look at the, like I knew the maker of the car. So
right.
If it was like a Mercedes, like just about a logo, the Mercedes, a Chevy.
Yeah.
Ford, a Mercury. A lot of these kids don't even know about the Mercuries and what else? The what car was? I'm trying to think of a car that's non-existent, like the Pontiac.
Oh, Pontiac, sure, yeah.
So like, I will always name like the maker or like the type of vehicle, and
yep.
Like nowadays, like I'm like, you know, I'm not a car enthusiast, but I love cars, like. In my mind, I told myself once I make, you know, a good amount of money in the future, in the near future, like, I want to collect vehicles, especially the vehicles that I always wanted, like, even, like, some of the old schools. I was born in the 90s, but a lot of my siblings, they was born in the 70s and early 80s, so to me, them cars back in them days was the way they looked was crazy.
That's some of my favorite era, like 60s and 70s cars.
Yes.
I love that.
So, yeah. Like, down here, you know, like I said, in Florida, you know, I'm from Miami, but every Florida boy, I guess even just the whole South, like, we always want Dunks. And you know, because originally from Carolina, right?
Yeah, actually. And I lived in LA a long time, but I'm actually back in Carolina now.
You know that culture down here, so it's
I know that whole subculture of cars, absolutely.
Yes. So it's like even my dad used to have this burgundy I think it was a Silverado. It was like a 1996 Silverado. It was burgundy. I love the way that that engine was sounding because it was V8.
Quick
question.
I know exactly. Yep.
Quick question. How do you? I'm sorry. Yeah. You go ahead.
Go ahead. You tell what I was. What do you ask?
No, and I was going to ask you, like, how do you feel about like electric and like they trying to go further more into electric in the next 10 years?
Yeah. I think you know. Okay, so I think there's definitely a place for electric cars. They're coming. It makes a lot of sense. Battery technology is still my biggest problems are with batteries are tricky because it's going to be weird for the used car market because batteries have kind of a lifespan and it's extremely expensive to replace a battery in an EV. So right now you can get like a, you know, you can get a 20-year-old gasoline car and it can still be extremely viable and it's not a big deal to keep those things going. In fact, I have all old cars. Like I've got a 73 Beetle and I have a weird Japanese market car from the early 90s and I have an old Yugo. I have like old weird stuff, but it's not a big deal to keep them going. EVs, the actual drivetrain, the mechanics of them are actually pretty simple and straightforward and long lasting, but the batteries, you know, after like right now, legally, they all have to be guaranteed for like 8 years and 100,000 miles for the battery. But that's not that old for the average age of a car now. So the used market for EVs is going to be strange. And I'm worried about what that's going to do to the low end of like people who rely on used cars to buy them, can't afford new cars. You're going to end up with something that could end up just being a huge liability after a while. Right? That's one of the bigger issues. I feel like batteries should be easily swappable instead of EVs. I think owning a battery is an inherent structural part of the car is not the best idea. And I think we're going to see a lot of changes in development as time goes on. Because right now, there are no old EVs really yet. Not really. Like in 2012 or 2010, maybe you got some Leafs and early Tesla Model S's. But as far as the cars themselves go, they're great. I mean, all the EVs, all modern EVs at least, are fast. They have a lot of torque. So they have great acceleration. Most of them are packaged really nicely now. So like basically the default way most electric cars are made today is the batteries are all in the bottom. The motors are mounted low, usually at the rear, sometimes at the front also. So you basically have like a skateboard that's all the mechanical stuff, which means the entire upper part of the car, the packaging that can be used for more. That's why so many electric cars have now like a trunk up front and in the back.
You know, yeah, I noticed that.
Yeah, there's more room that you can package things into, and that gives more freedom for the way you can design them. So, you know, there's a lot of people who are going to lament and miss some of the qualities of gas cars, and I totally get that because the one thing about EVs is they all generally drive and feel roughly the same. They all have good acceleration. They're all pretty quick. They're all kind of heavy because the batteries are heavy. And it used to be cars would have wildly different characters based on the kind of engine. Like, you know, like a V8 is going to feel different than an inline four or flat six or, you know, an Alde car is, you know, there's all kinds of different things that affect the way it sounds, the way it moves, the way it performs. Everything mechanically is kind of becoming more homogenized. And that's not necessarily bad from a practical standpoint, but you feel like a little bit of character gets lost. And so they're just going to have to make up for it in more interesting, you know, body design, interesting features in the car. They're going to have to compensate in some kind of ways to do that. And, you know, there's plenty of interesting EVs out there.
I know the Hummer looked real nice.
Yeah, those new Hummers are interesting. They're shockingly heavy, though. They're like, those things weigh like 6,000 pounds.
Yeah, that's crazy for an electric car. That's crazy.
Yeah. The batteries are heavy. Even like a Tesla Model 3 is about 4,000 pounds. And whereas like, you know, cars used to be more like 2,500, 2,800 pounds. But they're all heavy now.
It's heavy.
And that does affect how they handle. Luckily, all that weight is very low because the battery pack is usually low. So you want a low center of gravity. But if you have like a big, heavy SUV like that Hummer, I wonder how that thing is actually going to be to drive. I feel like you've got a lot of weight and it's tall, and that's usually not a great combination in for like how a car handles. But I don't, you know, I mean, nobody's going to take those things to the track or anything like that.
I think for, like I say, with music, in this decade, like, because I have, you know, spoken to a lot of DJs, a lot of artists, a lot of producers, even managers in the music industry, and I tell them my opinion is that, you know, we still gonna have streaming, like Apple, Tidal, you know, Spotify, but I feel like, you know, in the near future, we gonna end up having, you know, CDs may end up coming back, but people gonna start wanting physical again, and I feel like an idea is to have USBs. So with the auto industry, I know right now the goal, and I heard in California is crazy, like they trying to eliminate, I don't know if that's true or not, but they trying to eliminate gas, or they trying to like lower it down as far as like gas vehicles, like
There's no actual laws in place in California for anything like that yet. I think there are some goals that they have stated where they want to have a certain percentage of EVs by a certain date. And I know in Europe, they're even a little more aggressive about that kind of thing. You know, California has got a really rich car culture, especially collectors and vintage cars. LA just was a fan. I loved living in LA because the car culture and just the cars that were just around were absolutely amazing. And I think there will be respect for those old classics. I think there will always be a place for people to have those on the road, because it's a resource. It's like a reason you would go to LA, and they're not going to get rid of that. And there's so many people there who really care about that kind of thing that I think that's not going to go away. But mainstream cars probably are going to edge more and more towards EVs.
Yeah, and it sucks, but I feel like I don't know. For some reason, I feel like it won't disappear as what people think it will. As far as like, you know, like for example, I heard Dodge is trying to make the Charger electric. Like they're trying to make an electric version of it. Because I seen a Corvette. I'm not gonna lie, that's still the Corvette. The Corvette is one of my favorite cars ever. I don't care if it's you know gas or EV, but
They have the new. When the latest Corvette, the C8, came out, you know, the mid-engine Corvette. Even when it first came out, if you look inside it, space from the very beginning of this latest generation of Corvette that everybody could tell was already designed to take an electric motor, and now they just announced they are going to have a version with a motor and an electric motor in there as well. So I think the recent Corvette was designed from the get-go to be kind of both.
Wow.
It can still be, you know, I feel like you can still have an exciting, fun EV. And most car makers now do have plans, like, to become all EV at a certain point. I don't think that's going to change. And I think that's the path we're definitely on. And I don't think I'll certainly always want to have a gas car just for nostalgia and because I like old cars. But I don't lament that things are moving in that direction, because long term, if it's done right, I think it does make more sense. However, there's a lot of ifs, like the battery problem I mentioned.
Yes, that was a great point too. Nobody never talked about that. You bringing that up, because I watch YouTubers and they never bring that up. So that was a great point.
It's a big deal, because I mean, the used car market, the car makers don't think they can make a lot of money selling cheap cars anymore. Like, there used to be cars that were like, you know, you could used to be able to get a $10,000 to $12,000 car in America. And you can't really now, because the car makers have decided you can't really make money there. So they've kind of left that market to the used market. But lately, the used market's gone crazy because of all the supply chain issues. Cars are just more expensive. This is a terrible time to buy a car. Everything's expensive.
Yes.
And if the used market is going to be EVs that are over 8 years old, you're buying a time bomb, because that it's not a matter of if the battery will degrade and fail. It's just when.
Yeah,
because chemically, they start to degrade no matter what. That's just the lifespan of a battery. And they're better than we thought they would be like 10 years ago. They're lasting longer. They're doing pretty well, but that doesn't mean forever. And they still do fail. And I have yet to see a good solution for that. So there's a lot to be figured out as far as that goes. It's a problem. And, you know, we're actually on another weird precipice, like dividing line in the car world now. Mm-hmm. And that's with autonomy. I don't know how much you've heard about like self-driving cars.
Yes, I've heard a lot. I kind of have mixed feelings about that because I'm like, can I not drive on the highway? But then I'm like, if that happens, like, I'm not at that point where I can just trust a vehicle because I don't want to go to sleep and then, you know.
Yeah, and you should because. Yeah, it's a weird point we're at right now because, like, what you're feeling makes total sense. That's how a smart person should be thinking about these right now because they are not ready. And there's a lot of hype around them, especially from Tesla, where, you know, because Tesla even has something they call full self-driving that is not full self-driving. It's right now, the only cars that are actually on the market are something called, they have these different levels of self-driving. And the levels don't refer to, like, how advanced it is. They refer to different ways that the human and the car interact. Mm-hmm. So everything you buy now is what they call level two, which means even if the car is doing most of the work, you as the person in the driver's seat have to be alert and watching everything and ready to take over at a moment's notice because the car could just decide it doesn't know what to do and it needs you to be ready right away. So if you're sleeping in this car, that's bad news because
that's bad news.
It's a problem. And that's why I feel like the way Tesla calls it full self-driving or autopilot is kind of deceptive because it makes people think the car is doing more than it actually is. And these wrecks that have happened with people on autopilots because they haven't been using it as it needs to be used, which is like you have to pay attention. And human beings are not good at paying attention to something that's doing most of the work. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like if you have a machine that's like folding envelopes and your job is to just make sure it doesn't screw up, you're not likely to pay a lot of attention if it does the job right like 90% of the time. And just the nature of the way human beings work. And they've done studies to show this is the case. It's called the vigilance problem. We're just not good at that. And that's what these things want you to do. And the paradox is the better it is at doing most of the driving, the more dangerous it actually is because the more you're going to expect it to not need you until it suddenly does. And then who knows if you're awake or alert or paying attention and then you're screwed. So we're at a really weird point right now in this stuff. It's like the technology is partially there, but not entirely there. There's a lot of confusion among the public about how you actually are supposed to use these things. Mm-hmm. And it's just a lot of hype that's making people really confused. This is a weird time. It's a very much a transition time. I don't think that we're doing it the right way.
Yeah, it's very weird. Like I said earlier, you know, the pandemic, you know, when I read the article, it says that, you know, the pandemic pushed us like 5, 10, 15 years in the future. So I guess a lot of these companies, though, they feel like, hey, let's do this and do that just to keep the people, I guess, keep buying their products. But like for me, I started falling in love with GMC. And I always thought GMC was like an old person car, like growing up. But then, you know, I'm only 30 years old, you know, I'm still young, but I'm like, damn, like GMC, they trucks are, you know, they trucks, the SUVs, like they're very good. And speaking of you know, we was talking about the self-driving, you know, they keep having this commercial, I think it was the Denali Ultimate, I think that's the one that do the self-driving or whatnot.
Oh, yeah, at GM, that's right, because that's using GM, they call it a Super Cruise system.
Yes.
They're interesting because you don't actually have to have your hands on the wheel, but they have a camera that's actually tracking your eyes. So if it sees that you're not looking out the windshield and not paying attention to something, it'll like beep and like alert you that you need to like pay attention again.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So these, all of these cars that are level two that require a driver to pay attention have to have some kind of driver monitoring. And it's like Tesla's use like a sensor in the steering wheel to make sure your hand's on it. GM didn't want to have to require your hands on the wheels, so their system, like you're seeing on that Denali, has that camera. So you're it's weird because you're kind of the car. You're supposed to be paying attention to what the car is doing, and the car is kind of paying attention to what you're doing. It's this weird like cycle of like creeping on each other, like you and the car, like watching each other to make sure you're doing the right thing. When in the end, I just kind of think it's just easier just to drive the damn car.
Yeah, just drive it. Yeah, just drive. It's people getting too lazy right now. Like, it's come on now. So
it's not that hard. Drive your damn car.
So you brought it up earlier, and that was one of the questions I wanted to ask you. Since you're in the audio, industry. How do you feel about the prices, the inflation, the I go to, like, for me, I love looking at cars, looking at trucks, just looking at the whole vehicles in general. And I know it was like a chip. It was something going on with the different chip and the technology and whatnot. That's why they wasn't, they got the vehicles made, but it's not, I guess basically they saying that, it's not enough chips because the chips was used for other things during the pandemic. But how you feel about this whole thing? Like, and when you think it's going to get better?
That's a great question. I mean, because it is right now, it's a mess. If we're honest, like, if any of you people listening to this are thinking about buying the car, my advice would be if you can wait like 6 months, a year, whatever. This is the worst time to buy a new car or a car, because what you're talking about with the chips is basically when the pandemic started. Car makers all assumed that people probably weren't going to buy as many cars. So these fabricating companies that make all the microchips that are used in the various, because cars are full of computers now, they basically cut their orders. They said, we're not going to need as many, so we'll cut it off. And so all of those orders and all the capacity of those factories were filled, because one thing everybody was doing during the pandemic is buying new laptops, new Nintendo Switches and all kinds of phones and whatever, things that used all kinds of other microchips. So all of the fabricating companies were crazy busy building these for like consumer electronics companies. And then as the pandemic was tapering down and they realized people were actually starting to buy more cars than they thought, there was all of a sudden a demand for these very different chips that cars use. Because cars, they don't really use the most state-of-the-art chips in everything that like you'll find in like your laptop, because the environment of a car is hard. Like, it bounces and it's outside and it goes through cold and heat. Like, you don't drag your laptop around a street all day and leave it outside.
That's a no-no. So,
right, exactly. So the chips they use in cars tend to be kind of hardened to this. So they tend to be like maybe one generation behind, but they've been engineered so that they're more like rugged. So there are different kinds of chips. So it's not like the car makers could just buy the same chips that were already being built. They actually have to wait until the fabricating companies are ready to make their kind of chips they need. So what happened is they just didn't anticipate the demand. And then all of a sudden when there was demand, they didn't have this crucial component. They didn't have these chips. So production went way down and demand went way up. And that's why cars are so absurdly expensive right now. And that's why used cars are so expensive right now, because there's just not enough on the market for people to have. And in general, this is, I think, and even before this happened, I'm not a snob when it comes to cars. I love dirt cheap cars. My cars have always been like mass market things, like VW Beetles and Fiat 500s and Citroën 2CVs, like cheap ass ridiculous things that I just think have a lot of character but are dirt cheap. And we need, cars are important, especially for people. If you don't live in a city, I know it's people say you don't need a car. If you live in a city, that's absolutely true. You can get by with public transportation. But if you're in an area that doesn't have good public transportation, and an awful lot of the U.S. doesn't, and a lot of people live in more rural areas don't have a lot of money, you need a cheap car just to get around, to live your life, to get to work.
Yeah, I mean,
and what are your options?
Yeah, like, I mean, you look at, I mean, of course, New York, you don't really need a vehicle, but like places like Miami and LA, they're big cities, but they so spread out, you need a vehicle.
Exactly. LA, I mean, I when I lived in LA, I always had a car, or multiple cars, mm-hmm. I like them, but I briefly had a job where I was able to use public transportation, but that was rare. Like, that was really rare. And then most of the time in LA, it's big, it's spread out. You're mm-hmm. right, Miami's that way. I mean,
Dallas, Houston, like.
Right. All of these, like, and they're sprawling cities.
Mm-hmm.
And you need an independent way to get around. And cars, they should, like, it's the kind of thing where there really should always be some kind of affordable something on the market. And I feel like you just don't, like, the old days of, like, having, like, a Geo Metro or even, like, the Yugo, as much as people make that car, you know, that Yugoslavian car came out in the 80s, it cost $4,000, $39.95 new. It was like half as much as everything else. They weren't great, but they also weren't that bad, and they would definitely get your ass to and from work or wherever you needed to go.
Right.
Really nothing like that on the market now. Like, there's still a few cheap cars, like, but all the car makers are dropping that low end, and I hate that. I think there's a real place for a good, inexpensive car, and I think part of the problem is something changed in the way people, like, the idea of, there used to be cheap cars you could get that were free of, like, stigma
mm-hmm.
about being cheap, kind of classless. Like, a Beetle in America for a while was like this. Like, you could be a rich person and have a Beetle just because you liked one and you thought they were cool.
Right.
Or the Mini in England. We didn't really get them here, but they're really cool little cars. Like, you know, some of the members of the, like, Ringo Starr from the Beatles had a Mini because he liked it. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, somebody with, like, an entry-level job would also have a Mini. So there are these cars that kind of transcended your status in the social strata. And it didn't matter how much money you made. There was no shame in having just this kind of honest, cheap car. And I feel like now, even the cars that are cheap are trying to seem more premium. And there's, like, an inherent dishonesty about it. It, like, just feels wrong. And, like, you shouldn't be ashamed to have a cheap car. There's nothing sure. wrong with that. Cheap cars have as much dignity as a Bugatti, you know? And, in fact, it's a harder job to engineer a good, cheap car than it is, like, a really expensive car because of the restrictions. Like, mm-hmm. for example, and this is a weird, so in India, there was a company car maker called Tata, and they engineered a new car that could be sold for about $2,500.
Oh, wow.
And I've driven one of these. It's called a Tata Nano. It's a brilliant design. It's like a little, it's basically like a little four-door, like, one box kind of design, like a little tiny van in a way, with, like, a sloping front, engines under the floor in the back. It makes like 35 horsepower. And the goal of this thing was they wanted to get Indian families off of, like, mopeds and motorcycles. Cause I've been to India and I've driven around India, and mm-hmm. you will see, like, entire family on a motorcycle or moped. And it is not, they have, like, a kid on the handlebars and then three people on it.
That's crazy.
It's not any kind of car is going to be safer than that. So that was the goal of this thing. But because it was so famous for being the cheapest car in the world, even people who were at the absolute economic bottom didn't want to drive a car that everybody knew was the cheapest car in the world. Even if it meant they were still on a moped, they just felt like they didn't want to be known as someone who drove that. And objectively, that's crazy. Like, why should we care so much? But that's part of things. And for some reason, that kind of idea has saturated what it means to own a car. And that's kind of a problem because it means good, affordable cars are stuck with this kind of stigma that they don't really deserve. And that means car makers are less likely to want to try to build good, inexpensive cars mm-hmm. because they feel like people buy them because of this reputation, and you get this weird catch 22. So it's I don't know how to solve that because it's not a technical problem. It's a human psychology problem.
I think, I think it's a generational thing. I think it's I blame my generation, the millennials, in a way. When we got older, you know, we wanted to have more of a flashy vehicle.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we got the generation behind us, Gen Z, and they,
yeah.
I'm talking about, I talk to these kids all the time. I'm like, my first vehicle was an Impala. I was grateful. All these kids now, they want to have their first car. They want it to be a souped up V8 Charger or a Lamborghini. I'm like, when I was growing up, I seen the Lambo. I said, it looks good. But I'm like, I don't care about that vehicle right now. I told myself, I get that car when I'm like 45 or something.
Yeah.
These kids now, they just
can't start with that. And where do you go? I mean, I don't know. I just feel like there's nothing wrong with wanting what you want. There's nothing wrong with wanting a flashy car, having fun with it. But I also think, like, the idea, like, you should never judge someone because they drive a cheap car.
Exactly.
A cheap car has dignity, and there have been so many interesting cheap cars throughout history that have been really fantastic and done all kinds of amazing things. And I feel like that whole market is just gone. And I don't know, like, when someone, you know, like, it's tricky. Like, if someone is looking for a new car and they don't have a lot of money to spend, their options are just so limited. And it's just not a fair thing. It's like, there should be, every car maker should make something that's good and honest and is, you can be proud to drive at the bottom of their lineup.
Right. It's like, it's like the cell phone industry. You know, I tell people all the time, you know, I want a BlackBerry. BlackBerry was a simple phone that you could check your emails, you could text people. It was simple, you know. You got these iPhones, these Galaxies, all these other.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong, great phones, you know, but I feel like the BlackBerry is like, I want to call it like, I mean, back in them days, the BlackBerry it was expensive, but as time, you know, as technology advanced, BlackBerry came, it started to become that phone that was like budget to you, like it was cheap. But I'm like, this phone could do as much as the iPhone and last longer.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, yeah, and I don't know. We're humans and we're not rational and we don't do things for rational reasons, but at some point we got to have like some kind of check and balance here. Like, we got to realize, like, it's not sustainable. Like, there has to be a way for people to have the transportation they need.
Right.
And it's got to be affordable for them.
Exactly. So, So I have a couple more questions.
Okay.
And this is different because, like I said, you're the first person that I interviewed that's in the auto industry. And I have a top five section. So I ask people about their top five, you know, artists of all time, et cetera. Anything that's dealt with the industry. So from you is, what are your top five vehicles that you ever owned or driven before? Like, what's in your top five?
All right, let's see. So top five things I've driven. My favorite car, I'll do my top one first, is it's called a Tatra T87. It's a Czechoslovakian car from like the 1940s. And I love it because it's beautiful and really strange. It's like long and it has a V8, air-cooled V8 at the rear. And it has like a dorsal fin on the top, like a shark. And it looks kind of like a Zeppelin. Like, if you ask people what the future was going to be like in like 1935, they would have drawn a picture of this car. And that's not how the future happened. It went a very different direction. But I love it. It's this weird refugee of what people thought the future would be like at this one point. And it's strange and elegant and interesting. I love them. So that would be my top one.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see. Then, other top five cars I've driven. I love Beetles, and I drove this special, it's a desert racing Beetle. It was, there's a kind of desert race I did. I did this like Baja 1000 race in desert in Mexico. And there was a class called the Class 11 where they have, it looks like just regular stock VW Beetles, but they're just toughened up just a little bit when they drive them out there. And I drove one of those once and I loved it because it was just like a tough version of my Beetle. And it was just a blast. It was just, you know, it had all the charm and the humbleness of a Beetle, but it was just unstoppable. It was great. So it'd be that one. And I love, I like, micro cars. So there's like a weird category of cars. These were big in Europe after World War II when nobody had any money. So they made these weird little tiny cars. Mm-hmm. There was one called an Isetta that BMW actually made. These are the cars that really saved BMW right after the war. And it's shaped kind of like an egg, and the door is on the front like a refrigerator.
I've seen that. I've seen that before. I'm like, how people like fit in that car? I'm like 6'1", 6'2". I'm like, I don't know how would I fit in a...
Oh, you'd be... I mean, I'm very tiny. I'm like 5. I don't even think I'm 5'6". If I'm completely honest. One of the nice things about being this small, though, is that, well, I'm always comfortable in airplanes, mm-hmm. and I can fit in any weird-ass little car. So one of those, I think, would be up there. What's something else I've driven that would be fun? I drove a car that used a propeller instead of to get around. It was like it was called a Helicron. That thing was terrible, but how ridiculous it was. And it was like a wingless airplane that you drove around. I might put that on the list. And then for like the last one, an amphibious car. You know about these? They could go in water or land. I drove one. It was called an Amphicar. I've driven a couple of these, but. It's not a particularly great car and not a particularly great boat, but the fact that it can be both, that moment when you just drive right into a lake, just go down that ramp and just plow right into the lake, is one of the best experiences I've ever had in a car, because it's just fun. It's just ridiculous and fun, and I think I don't know why amphibious cars are not more popular, because I think they're such a good time.
It should, because I've seen it before. I've seen a video of it before. They should be, because it's like, you know, especially where I'm from, you know, it's a whole bunch of water and stuff. So it's like, why not?
Exactly. So I've got like a canoe that I take my kid out in all the time, and I put it on the roof of my car, and it's a pain in the ass to get off and in the water. And all we really do in the water, you just, you know, we like drive there and you get the canoe out. You just kind of dick around in the water. It's not like we're doing anything that impressive in the water. So it doesn't have to be that good a boat. It just has to be good enough that you drive it in there and it doesn't sink, and you hang out and you lay on it and you drink beer and you swim and you have fun, and then you pull out and you drive home. It's just like, that should be a thing. I don't understand why these aren't being sold all over the place. So
yeah, I guess people's afraid of the unknown, and you know, out in the water.
I guess that's probably right, but I think there's a place for them. That would be in my top five also.
And last question is, where do you see yourself 5 to 10 years from now?
That's a good question. Well, I think since we started this website, I want to see this website get big. Mm. I want to see this become like the go-to site for people who love cars and want to talk about cars and read about cars. And I'd like to also, one of the things we've been talking about more is moving into more video and maybe more like, streaming service kind of video, Netflix. So in 10 years, I'd love it if the Autopian was doing great, had huge traffic, and if the Autopian had some kind of series on one of the streaming providers like Netflix or Apple TV or whatever. Those would be great goals. I would love that.
Don't forget about me.
We'll get you on there. Whatever you want.
Because I was looking on your website, it kind of reminds me of, what's the website? Derek Jeter created it. The Players Tribune.
Yeah, that's what.
The Players Tribune. But it's for cars. And for like people who just love, you know, certain vehicles. And like, I always told myself one day that if I could be part of any community, whether it's sports or whatever, anything that I love, like I want to write an article or write a journal and just talk about it, you know.
And that's exactly, you're right. And I was just looking at the Players Tribune now, and I think that's dead on. I think that's exactly right, because it almost doesn't matter what the topic is, sports or cars or whatever. This is just a place where interested people write about the things they love, and they get maybe experts who know things to give information, and a community of people who are engaged and love it as well. That's all it is. So, yeah, I think you're exactly right.
Yeah, because when I get my 7 Tre or 7.2, 7.4, I want to take a picture of it and just talk about it, you know.
Yeah. And you want to talk to other people who are into it also, and mm-hmm. you understand how cool it is and all of that. 100%. You're absolutely right.
Right. So before we end the podcast, you have any shout outs?
Yeah, I want to shout out to David Tracy, my partner at the Autopian, Bo Bachman, my other partner, my wife Sally, my kid Otto. Mm-hmm. All those good people. And please, everybody, if you can come out to the Autopian.com, please do. And if you're interested in a book about the future of autonomous vehicles, Robot Take the Wheel, you can find that on Amazon, or better yet, go, if you have an independent bookstore, you know, give them your money before Amazon. But there you go.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to read that book, and we're gonna have to have a part two or something in the near future, because that book seems very interesting.
Well, thank you. I hope it is.
So, thank you so much. Once again, you know, like I tell everybody, I know, you know, you're a father, you're a husband, you're a business owner. Time is very precious for all of us. So, you know, I appreciate you coming on the show. You know, hopefully we have more interactions, you know, even outside the show.
Sure.
That's what it's all about, just building and networking and meeting new people. And I appreciate you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I really appreciate you having me on the show. This sounds great. And I will, hopefully I'll talk to you in the future as well. So thanks again.
No problem. Everybody's been your boy.
DJ
Anonymous with another episode of Sports Biz Music with my boy Jason, and we out. Peace.
Have fun. Thank you.